Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hello, this is Dave Cornelison for STEM Spots on the webcast version, and with me in the studio, or actually through the magic of the internet, I have Dr. Will Grundy, who's a tenured astronomer at Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, and also the lead for the Surface Composition Science Theme Team for NASA's New Horizons Science Team. Thanks very much for speaking to us, Will.
It's great to be with you today.
So, well, of course, the New Horizons mission has been in the press for a while now, and of course, it's always been tantalizingly closer and closer to its object of attack, which is Pluto. And of course, in the past few months, we have actually gotten to closest approach, and people are very interested in this mission. And so if you could, I'd like you to start off talking a little bit about how this whole thing gets put together. Briefly discuss concept to fruition, if you could, including putting a team together and pitching the idea and so forth and so on.
Yeah, there's a lot of history there. It goes way back to really the 1980s for us, after the Voyager flyby of Neptune revealed amazing diversity of terrains on Triton, Neptune's large moon that we now know to be captured from the Kuiper Belt. There was a real push to go have a look at Pluto and finish the job. You remember the Postal Service had a stamp series where they had the dates of exploration of all of the planets, and Pluto was provocatively titled Not Yet Explored, back when stamps were 29 cents for a first class stamp. So there's a long process of building the case through the scientific community, working within the community to explain why this is scientifically valuable. The National Academies does studies every decade to try to assess priorities going forward, and that's a key part of building the case is getting a consensus view within the community that this is very important. You have to build a proposal team, which involves industry, the people that are capable of building the hardware, all of the instruments, the scientists who can make the case in a proposal, and it's a very laborious effort that takes really many decades to pull together. And it was finally funded in early, I think it was 2001. And then, of course, once the funds are secure, you have to build the hardware, make sure that you pass a lot of rigorous engineering reviews to make sure that it's going to work and do what it's designed to do, and get approval for launch and so on. And we had a relatively short amount of time to do that. It was basically 4 years to get the hardware built and delivered to Kennedy Space Center for launch. And the launch was at the beginning of 2006. And since then, New Horizons has been outbound from the inner solar system where we live on Earth at a pretty fast rate of speed, but about a decade to get out to Pluto. And so during that time, you need to keep the team sharp. You need to make sure that the hardware is still working in flight, check in periodically, and so on. So that's a history of the last few decades of many, many planetary scientists who've been working to do this.
So ultimately, since this actually came about, or at least people were thinking about it, before Pluto was demoted to a dwarf planet, is that right then?
Yeah, in fact, it was even launched before that happened. so the first target that changed its status while a spacecraft was en route to explore it.
Now it's part of the Kuiper Belt. And this whole idea of the Kuiper Belt of objects, when was that sort of put forth and agreed upon?
So the idea of the Kuiper Belt, the name comes from Gerard Kuiper, who was an influential planetary astronomer in the middle of the 20th century. Kenneth Edgeworth, an Irish astronomer, also had similar ideas. When Pluto was first discovered, it was a weird oddball, and these guys started to realize that maybe it wasn't such an oddball, maybe it was the tip of an iceberg of small bodies out there, another asteroid belt. And that was an idea that gained momentum in the 1980s when it was noticed that the orbits of a lot of comets are sort of confined to the plane of the solar system as if they came from a disk rather than a uniformly distributed cloud, such as the Oort cloud. But the first one wasn't actually discovered you know, other than Pluto until 1992, so relatively recently, basically about a quarter of a century ago. And since that first discovery, there's been more than a thousand of them discovered, and it's recognized that this is a much larger structure than the asteroid belt. In fact, it's a very large, massive region of the solar system. It's sort of a whole third region of the solar system that's never really been visited by a spacecraft before. So it was relatively easy to build the case for a mission to Pluto and the Kuiper Belt because scientists really wanted to get a look at this region.
And so would that mean that that's a primordial piece of the early disk, or is that captured material? Where would the Kuiper Belt have come from?
These are probably residues from the era of planet formation. It looks like you build objects in the sort of 50 to 100 kilometer size range, planetesimals, fairly quickly, and then those slowly agglomerate into larger objects. And by the time you get up to something that's Earth-sized or bigger, it can attract a substantial atmosphere, and Uranus and Neptune and the other giant planets are examples of that. Pluto-sized objects, of which there are several in the Kuiper Belt, Eris is another good example, are large enough to be active and interesting worlds and to have certainly erased a lot of their primordial surfaces by geological activity. But they're sort of halfway in between these primitive planetesimals that are your sort of run-of-the-mill small Kuiper Belt object and giant gas-shrouded planets where you can't even see the surface if there is a surface deep down inside.
So do you think that that means in the last 10 years, as it was en route, your actual scientific questions that you were going to ask got modified in any substantial way?
Well, sure. Science continuously evolves, and the more you learn, the smarter you get at asking questions. Obviously, we couldn't update the scientific payload aboard, but it really is the most modern scientific payload that's been sent on a first exploration like this. You can kind of think of cell phone technology back when the Voyager spacecraft were launched in the 1970s. There was none, by the time New Horizons was launched in 2006, the technology had come a long ways.
Right. So you've got your scientific concepts down, and your particular team, the surface composition theme team, what were your particular goals?
Well, we're particularly interested in the materials that the surface of Pluto and Charon and the other small moons in the system are made of, and how those materials behave under cryogenic conditions. We've experimented a lot with you and I together, in fact, with frozen nitrogen and methane and so on in the laboratory, and that gives you one insight into them. But what happens if you have an entire planetary surface covered with these kind of materials? What kinds of strange landforms does it make? How does it evolve on seasonal timescales or geological timescales? And so the imagery from New Horizons gives us that angle on it, and we're interested in how they interact. How the surface evolves over time. We'd love to be able to understand it so well that we can play the tape backwards and say, what was the surface like in ancient history?
You're not only looking at images, you also have some spectrometers on there. So is your team looking at data that would come from the spectrometers?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The near-infrared wavelength region, just wavelengths just a smidge longer than what the human eye can see, are incredibly sensitive to the compositions of different materials. Different molecules vibrate at different frequency, and so they absorb light at some wavelengths and not at other wavelengths. And so you can look at a spectrum of an area on the surface of some alien body, and you can say what that surface is made out of. And New Horizons has an imaging spectrometer, which basically means that every pixel of the image, instead of just having a color information like a color digital camera would have, every pixel gets a spectrum. And so we can say what every pixel of that scene is made out of. And we can see if, you know, a crater digs down through some surface material and exposes some other material from down below, or if the hills are capped with a different material that's maybe deposited by the atmosphere, or, glaciers flowing in valleys. You know, who knows? We can say what it's made out of. And then we can go to the lab and try to understand its mechanical properties, and work with the geologists and geophysicists to try to understand the processes that made the scene that we're seeing.
What kind of spatial resolution? So usually, if you look at Pluto from the Earth, you're going to fill the entire scene with just Pluto. And so now you're resolving features that are how large when you got your flyby?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, from ground-based telescopes, the best you can do is put a few pixels across Pluto. So you can see that there are some features, but you can't really see the details. We are mapping the surface with this imaging spectrometer at a little bit better than 10 kilometers per pixel. So it's still not high enough resolution that you could see human footprints or, a very, very small features, but you can certainly see a diversity of landforms at that spatial scale. And we have color imagery at higher spatial resolution and then black and white imagery, just normal, digital camera stuff at higher spatial resolution still. And the highest spatial resolution we'll get anywhere is a bit better than 100 meters per pixel. So you would see a football stadium or a tennis court as a distinct feature.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about when you actually started getting close and through the flyby. Did everything go according to plan? Did the data come back the way you expected it to? We'll talk a little bit in a moment about whether you saw anything that was unexpected, but it started getting close. You started to turn everything on. Did everything go according to plan?
Well, there was one glitch, which was July 4th, so 10 days before the closest approach, when the spacecraft went safe. And I have to hand it to the operations team. They really worked around the clock, worked smart. It's tricky to do when the round trip light time is about 9 hours. So you send a transmission and the spacecraft won't hear it until 4.5 hours later. And then it transmits its response and you don't get that until 4.5 hours later. So they got the spacecraft back on track in a few days, and basically not much was lost because it was still far enough out that that it hadn't gone into the close approach phase yet. But that had us all sweating, let me tell you.
I wouldn't believe that would be true.
I was on a red eye flying in that night, and boy, I was glad that I didn't get the email right before I got on the plane, because otherwise I would not have slept at all on that plane.
So the data does start to stream in, and I know you can't talk about all of it necessarily. You don't even have all the data on the ground. I mean, what percentage of data might you already have?
It's a pretty small fraction. For instance, the compositional data, we have no proper full data set where we have a spectrum for each pixel. We've got limited wavelengths and limited subsets of the pixels, and that's simply because it just takes too long to radio stuff home. The spacecraft, when it was doing the close encounter, it was full time pointing the cameras, taking data sets, twisting and turning, looking at the different objects in the system. And there was just no time to point the antenna back towards Earth. So really the data that we've got are just a few samplings. There was a contingency data set that was sent home right before the closest approach, just because in the slim chance that the spacecraft would be destroyed or some terrible mishap would happen as you flew through the system, we would like to have at least something on the ground before then. And then immediately after closest approach, it phoned home and said, and sent a few more things down just so that we would have something to show, to give us a taste, something that we could show to the public. But now we're going into a phase where we're slowly transmitting down everything in its full glory, not compressed, not lossy compressed, and not little tiny boxes of data. And we're just waiting for that stuff to come down. But as soon as it does, we will start releasing it. We're eager to release it as well. We're not sitting on a bunch of stuff that we haven't showed yet.
From your perspective then, what would be the most surprising thing so far? There's this image of this large feature, which suggests a geologically active young surface. Are you interested in what that might be made out of? There's been speculation that it can't be... it can't be soft, so it has to be water or something like that, water ice.
Let me back up a little bit. I mean, if you go to www.nasa.gov/newhorizons, all one word, you can look at these images that we're talking about. This region, Tombaugh Regio, is what we're calling it informally. It's the area that had been described as a heart. It looks vaguely heart-shaped. And that area is a weird region. It is superimposed on a pattern that is maybe what you might expect, which is different latitude bands that have different colors and compositions. And then there's this heart thing that just splatted down on top of that and interrupts the pattern. And it is geologically extremely young. It shows evidence of flow, like glacial flow, at its margins. It's unusually rich in nitrogen and carbon monoxide ice, which are very volatile materials and mobile at Pluto surface temperatures. But why is that there? That's the big mystery. I'd love to sort that out. Is it something that's erupting from within Pluto, or is it the residue of something that was deposited from the exterior, or is it just the local cold trap? You know, so because the albedo of that region, the amount of sunlight that it absorbs is very low because it's so bright, it just stays cold and it traps that stuff. That's really the big question that everybody's eager to solve when we get more data down.
But you would say that there have been several what you could actually call surprises then, reasonably?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's been enough feverish speculation that somebody has probably speculated almost everything, but and even contradicted themselves with their own speculations. But the relative lack of craters on Charon, for instance, is a bit of a surprise. That hints that either the surface is younger than we thought, or there's less debris out there that's crashing into stuff. This Tombaugh-Reggio area, really the central part of it, which we've been calling Sputnik Planum, is really kind of surprising. I mean, nitrogen glaciers. I did find an old talk I gave about a dozen years ago where I speculated about nitrogen glaciers, but it was just a wild speculation back then, and I haven't been going on about it since.
Sure.
It's pretty
amazing. Will you get spectroscopic data spatially resolved in that region then, or?
Oh yeah, you bet. I mean, we've already got some limited wavelengths so that we can say that that there is more of the volatile ices in those regions, nitrogen and carbon monoxide to be specific, which are somewhat more volatile than methane, which is the other ice that's seen all around the surface of Pluto. But we're going to get much better quality data. Those spectra, if you can even call them that, were seven wavelengths, strategically selected wavelengths, but what we're gonna get down is 256 wavelengths for each point on the surface, and we haven't got that down yet.
So let's say when you do get this down, what is the fraction of your life over the next X number of years that will have to be devoted to analyzing what has just happened?
Well, I wouldn't describe it as have to be devoted. I'm
Which
eager
you would to, love to devote.
Yeah, that's a better characterization of it. I think there's going to be a lot of interesting work to do, and I don't think it's going to all be looking at New Horizons data either. I think it'll be going back to the telescope and trying new observational techniques based on what we learned from the New Horizons data, going back to the lab and trying different experiments with different ice mixtures, because maybe some interesting property emerges when you mix these ices together in proportions that we see based on the New Horizons data. And there will also be a lot of interest in looking at some of the other objects that are related to Pluto, like Eris and Makemake, that also have methane and nitrogen on their surfaces. And it'll be a long time before we ever get a spacecraft to one of those objects, maybe not in my lifetime, but we can certainly look at them with telescopes, and the telescope technology just keeps improving. So there's always an incentive to keep going back with the latest instruments and see what they can reveal.
But that segues into my last question, which is the New Horizons team plans to try and send the probe onto another Kuiper Belt object. When is that likely to occur? When do you have to make a decision, and how long will it take to get to one of these objects?
So the dense part of the Kuiper Belt is a fairly narrow plane that's the same plane as the rest of the solar system. And we are, by good luck, basically good timing, we flew past Pluto right as its orbit crossed that plane, which means that the spacecraft is outbound in that plane. And we'll go through the thick part in 2018 and 2019. And so if there's a, and a couple of targets have been found, small Kuiper Belt objects in the, you know, 20, 30, 40 kilometer range. And so we could fly past one of those. We'll make a decision, well, really NASA will make a decision very soon about which of the two viable candidates that have been found to aim towards. And we, as a team, the New Horizons team, will need to put in a proposal to get some funding to actually cover an encounter in 2018 or 2019 when we would go past that object. And it's, of course, very exciting to see one of these little objects because these are the building blocks that things like Pluto and ultimately Uranus, Neptune, and much larger objects are built out of. And they've been out in the deep freeze, basically the attic of the solar system, where they've been cold and more or less inert for the last 4.5 billion years. And it'd be great to get a look at one of these building blocks, these planetesimals up close, and see what they're like.
Well, that's great. I really appreciate you being willing to talk to us about this. And if you haven't listened to the radio version of this, this is the webcast version of STEM Spots, and this was Will Grundy from Flagstaff, Arizona at Lowell Observatory talking with me, and I'm Dave Cornelison. Thanks very much.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.